Virginia and Duke University. His research addresses the ecological and evolutionary forces that shape systems of inheritance and the dynamics of disease in natural populations. Please welcome Professor Michael Hood.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. My research kind of has these two lines of inquiry that were just mentioned. One has to do with evolutionary genomics, and the other has to do with the ecology and evolutionary biology of infectious disease. And it's the latter that I'll talk about today. And the title of my talk is Getting Our Hands Dirty, and it's Studies of Wildlife to Understand Disease Transmission. And I, in case I run out of time at the end, I'll try not to, but I want to acknowledge that support for this research comes from the National Science Foundation. Currently, we're funded by the National Institutes of Health and also support from the college here. And my work is pretty collaborative with folks at the University of Virginia, which is Yannis Antonovics and Emmy Bruns, and with Tatiana Giraud at the University of Paris Sud. And our work that I'll talk about in the field is done in the southern Italian Alps, along with Parco del Margares there. Okay. Okay, so as an overview of what I'd like to talk about, I want to express that I'm interested in the fundamental processes affecting disease distributions. I'm interested in dynamics, interactions that are not particular to any particular group of organisms, but can be applied whether we're talking about infectious diseases of plants, which is what I study, animals, insects, humans, or any other. These are important dynamics because they're major forces affecting the coevolution and diversification of organisms. Every organism in the world gets disease of some kind, and that imposes natural selection upon that organism to overcome that disease or avoid that disease. And the majority of species on the planet are parasites or pathogens. These types of interactions also influence natural host populations and communities. I took for that as an example the forest blight, which when we look out at these hills beyond the campus, we see a canopy of oak and maples. Well, 100 years ago, a pathogen was introduced that changed it from its previous form, which was dominated by the American chestnut. The introduction of that disease completely changed our forest communities and all the organisms that relied on the chestnut for their food. And also economically, especially in the southern Appalachians, where it probably contributes quite a bit, the loss of the chestnut, to some of their economic troubles over the last century. Also, understanding the distribution and the forces that drive infectious diseases is important because it helps, helps to give us predictors of where they may have harmful effects that we want to intervene with. And also, in particular, including the emergence of new diseases into the human population. Okay. So essentially, to boil down what I'd like to ask about in my research, it is what determines who gets diseased and how badly are they affected? Why not study these types of dynamics in humans? Well, there's a couple of reasons. I'm an empiricist, an experimental biologist, and we can't do those experiments in humans, both for ethical and logistical reasons. Our experiments, as you can see in this picture on the lower right, are on plants where we typically have up to 10,000 individuals included in a space much, much smaller than this room. Also, when we're talking about diseases in humans, there is often a need and desire to intervene, and that intervention changes the natural ecology and evolution of that system. Now, as an evolutionary biologist or ecologist, I want to know what those fundamental processes are and how they act in the absence of intervention. Okay, so what models to use? You want to use, for these types of studies, models that are tractable like you would find in other laboratory model systems. We use plants. The diseases that they get don't affect the human handlers. They're easy and conspicuous to spot. And they're great for rearing large numbers of individuals from seed to flowering plant. Okay, so what questions to ask? In my research, we focused for a while on the dynamics of disease transmission, because that is one of the most fundamental stages in a disease life cycle. It determines the dynamics of epidemics. It determines so much about disease's role in natural ecosystems. And this is the organism that we study. It's called anthersmut disease. So the smut diseases were first named before our current connotation of the word smut. It comes from schmutz, right, which means dirty. And this is called the anthersmut disease because what happens is a fungus invades these plants, grows inside of them, and then replaces the pollen with spores of the fungus. And as a result, the pollinators that would come and get nectar will then spread the spores of the pathogen around. These are fungi in the genus Microbotrium. They're related to some other rust diseases that you might have heard about. This particular disease is interesting in many aspects of its biology. It does some curious things, like when it infects females, this is a plant that has separate sexes, when it infects females of this species, it actually manipulates the hormonal balance in that plant, causes the ovary to abort, and causes that genetically female individual to produce male structures in which the fungus sporulates. So it does some remarkably interesting things. And it's caught the attention of some really prominent historic biologists. Carl Linnaeus, the father of our modern taxonomy or naming of species, described it like this. It's in Latin above, but the translation is, the marriage bed, bright, snowy white, while in the venereal act, all the sheets are seen spotted with an ash-colored blackish dust. That's pretty good. This is the second half of the 1700s. Charles Darwin, right, just as, if not more famous, was a bit more dismissive, called this a mere mass of cryptogamic powder when he encountered it in one of his studies. We've been interested in this disease because to us it's very conspicuous when we see it, and we have focused on a series of projects trying to understand the disease distribution at different kind of spatial scales. These are two that I just throw up out of interest. I'm going to talk more detail about one on the following slides. We've been studying how the host, it's a flowering plant in the family that contains carnations, so it's a wild relative of carnations, how that plant in Europe has some genetic structure to those plants in the wild that reflects their migrations out of the most recent glacial refugia. So there was a refuge from the last glaciation, ice age, in the Iberian Peninsula, in the Italian Peninsula, and in the Baltics. And when that ice sheet retreated, organisms migrated back into that uncovered parts of Central and Northern Europe, and they retained some of the genetic identity of the region where they spent the glaciation. And on the left, you can see in different colors showing essentially the genetic lineages of the plant. And on the right, you can see the same pattern reflecting the genetic lineages of the pathogen. So as the host migrated out of those glacial refugia, the pathogen migrated right along with it and maintains that spatial structure. We've been interested in environmental factors. We did a study recently on the effects of the radiation levels around Chernobyl on the distribution and abundance of this disease and found some significant effects there, primarily driven, we think, by effects on the pollinators that really drive the transmission of this disease through their foraging behavior. The biggest project that we've done, looking at distributions at a global scale, we actually use museum specimens. So we went to the Natural History Museum, like at the Smithsonian, for example, and in those collections, there are preserved plants from all over the world. And the nice thing about these preserved plants is it tells you on the label what the host species is, the date, and the place where it was collected. And biologists and naturalists collected plants without realizing that they contained this disease. So we can go through and mine those collections for observations of the disease, and we can get a global distribution of the disease by that method. We looked at over 42,000 specimens from all over the world except Australia, where this genus is absent. We are focusing on this genus Silene within the carnation family. And what you can see is a very nice global distribution map of this disease derived just from museum collections alone. We could determine that about 1.5% of all the individuals sampled had this disease. And we could estimate that about 80% of the species, and there are hundreds of species, each harbor this particular disease. We could look at some dynamics of co-dispersal, sort of like we did with the retreat of the glaciers, but here looking at an intercontinental scale of dispersal of the hosts and their disease. What's highlighted in this table by different continents are, in the furthest right column, are the number of species found there, which is often used as a surrogate measure for where the center of origin is. It's thought to be somewhere between Europe and Asia. And as those hosts distributed around into Africa, into further parts of Asia, around Beringia, into North America, and down into South America, they brought their pathogens, this particular anthrosmut pathogen, along with them. It turns out that this is true at a very specific sense, that the hosts bring their pathogens with them. If we look at two different genera within this family, the top one is Silene, and it shows the distribution of Silene and outlined in red, and the number of species in that genus in a couple of different areas, in the Old World and the New World. And the disease is everywhere. Contrast that with the genus Dianthus. Dianthus also originated in this area between Europe and Asia. However, only one species of Dianthus, Dianthus repens, has made it around Beringia into the Americas, probably in one of the recent glaciations. And it's only found native in Alaska. Well, it turns out that when we look at that one species of Dianthus, it's diseased. So in the Newark Botanic Garden, there were 5 specimens, and one of them was diseased. So everywhere the host goes, it brings its pathogens with it. Now, these natural history museums are rich in both the history of the biological world. There's also a good bit of natural history about our own behavior in the past as well. That one specimen that was diseased from Dianthus repens in Alaska was collected by Bannister, who was a member of the Western Union Telegraph Exploring Expedition in the 1860s. So there were 2 efforts to connect the telegraph up between America and Europe. There was the transatlantic efforts, which were subject to lots of failures along the way. And another group was trying to run it around through Beringia, through Russia, and then to Europe. And that was this group. And of course, if you were Western Union in the 1860s, and you were going on an expedition like this to find a route for the telegraph, you would send botanists along with them. And those botanists would make collections because they were exploring new areas. And this was one example that came from that study. Unbeknownst to Bannister, it would become important 150 years later. Even within a species, so what we were looking at before were these sort of genus-wide distributions of many species of plants and their associated pathogens. Here is a map, doesn't show up super well. This is a map, a polar view of the northern hemisphere, and it's showing in green the distribution of one plant, one species. It's called Silene caulis, and here it is. And the red dots are the distribution of disease specimens, so where the pathogen is found. Now, I draw your attention to that one blue dot there in particular, another bit of history from the museum. This particular specimen was from Robert McCormick The label first caught my eye because it said Parry's attempt to reach the North Pole, which is a very famous expedition. But then when I saw who the collector was, this is Robert McCormick. This is a few years before McCormick was to be the naturalist on the Beagle. And Darwin was to be the sort of captain's friend on that expedition. Well, they were a bit like this. McCormick wanted to be the naturalist, but Darwin sort of took over that role on the Beagle's expedition. And that's Darwin's quote up there at the top when he wrote back when they ported somewhere. My friend the doctor is an ass, Charles Darwin wrote. And I think they just disagreed on who was playing the proper role as naturalist on the boat. Anyway, wonderful history of both the biology and the people and our learning about these natural systems. Okay, so what do we learn about the biology? One of the things that we saw when we looked at this global distribution of this particular species is that if we went from the southern region to the northern region, we saw that the amount of the host, the number of places where it was collected, okay, went down. So it's a little bit more common in the southern region, which means no further south than here, right? But from about here up quite north into the Canadian archipelagos, for example, we see a decline in this density of the hosts. But across that same distribution from south to north, we see an increase in the amount of disease that's there. And that suggested to us that there was some relationship between the abundance of the host and the amount of disease that they suffer. Okay? The curious thing was that this relationship was in the opposite direction of what you might expect. We have great concerns about putting lots of people together in close proximity because they risk the outbreaks of disease. We rarefy them and we're less concerned about that. So something was going on about this relationship between density and disease that was in contrast to what we'd seen before. So I wanted to now talk just for a bit before I get to our field studies that we're doing now about disease transmission, because there's some jargon here that is important to understand. There's two ways that we could think about disease being transmitted differently. The first is this idea of vertical transmission versus horizontal transmission. Vertical transmission would be from parent to offspring, whereas horizontal transmission would be between unrelated individuals. Okay, so that's one way. And as I'll mention in the next slide, that's been studied quite a bit. The other way that we could think about disease transmission being categorized is on the actual mechanism by which it's spread among the individuals. And this tends to fall in three main categories. There are sexually transmitted diseases. I had to make up my own icon for that. Which are spread through sexual contact. There is ordinary infectious diseases, and these are ones that we normally assume are due to being in proximity to somebody who has the disease or some sort of non-sexual contact that individuals have, shaking hands, for example, bouncing into one another on a dance floor, something like that. And then the third category are vector-borne diseases. These are diseases spread by insects. Okay, so what about these diseases? Well, the first category, this distinction, okay, here, has been studied a lot because of how we understand it affects the virulence of disease. If you have a vertically transmitted disease from parent to offspring that's very, very virulent, that's the only way it's transmitted, it's very difficult for that type of disease to persist. A disease that transmits horizontally is more readily able to evolve higher levels of virulence. Okay, so that's been studied quite a bit. The distinction between these types of diseases is a bit different. These have to do with whether a disease is likely to be found within a population and whether the disease is likely to drive that population to extinction. And it's all tied into this aspect of the ordinary infectious diseases. These diseases, based on proximity or contact, have a density threshold where if you rarefy the individuals, they simply don't contact each other enough to spread the disease around. Okay? Whereas sexually transmitted diseases you can spread those individuals out all you want, pretty much, and they'll seek each other out for the opportunity to reproduce. Okay? And the same with vector-borne diseases. As you spread individuals out, those vectors will fly further in order to seek a blood meal, for example. Okay? As people have examined the interaction between vertical and horizontal transmission, particularly in human diseases, where there are a number of cases, a number of types of diseases that are spread horizontally, but then also from mother to offspring, such as HIV/AIDS, there's been less looking at the dynamics between these different types of transmission, between sexual transmission, ordinary contact transmission, and vector transmission. Essentially no studies at all at those interactions. And so that's what we endeavored to look into. It turns out that when we put in this proposal to study those interactions, in the news coming out shortly after, this was in 2016, there was a pretty remarkable findings in some of the most alarming diseases currently in the human population. Both Ebola, which is thought to be spread through ordinary contact, and Zika virus, which was thought to be spread primarily or essentially through vector-borne transmission, were both found to have sexual transmission as one of their routes to move between hosts. So this idea of why some diseases specialize into one form of transmission, sexual or contact or vectored, and why others specialize in some other form of transmission is a fundamental part of their biology, but it also has consequences for how those populations, how populations of their hosts and diseases persist in the wild. Okay, so what about our anthrosmut disease? We assume this is a disease that has a combination, we believe now, of vector-borne transmission by the pollinators and also some proximity effect because, as Linnaeus said, those spores essentially filth up the nearby area. They fall, as you can see in this picture, from those diseased flowers, potentially hitting other hosts and transmitting to them. So, when we did get into the literature to try and ask what are the dynamics of these different types of vector-borne diseases and density-dependent diseases in nature, there was one particular hypothesis that caught our eye, and it's called the disease-free halo hypothesis. So let me explain how that works. If you have some distance from a good resource, okay, so there's less good resources here and quite bad resources here, you would expect that host to have a range of density, this is host density or abundance, that is high close to that good resource and lower as you go further away because hosts that live here have a harder time surviving and reproducing. So we have a gradient in host density. Well, remember, for those ordinary contact diseases, those ones that require proximity, there is a threshold for disease transmission. And as the host declines in density, there's some point where the hosts are so rarefied that the disease can't persist anymore. And this is called a disease-free halo. That's expected to occur out at those margins of a distribution. This disease-free halo has been seen in a couple of systems. It's been seen in a rust disease of a sedge. It's been seen in some virus of wasps. It's been seen in some parasitic bumblebees that parasitize other bees. But what about diseases that have a transmission that is vector-borne or like a sexual transmitted disease? Well, because as you rarefy the hosts, they will seek each other out for mating opportunities, or the vectors will just fly further for another blood meal or nectar meal, we don't expect a density threshold for where the disease drops out. The disease ought to go right to the boundary of that host distribution. And so that's the hypothesis that we wanted to test. And so how did we do this? We've been doing this over the course of about 6 or 7 years now with this specific goal. We chose a site in the Western Alps, in the Southern Alps, where we were using elevational gradients as a resource or a habitat gradient across which different species would be at high abundance at one elevation and low abundance at the upper or lower limits of where they could survive. And we looked at a whole bunch of different species, and we did this by hiking up the mountains and making observations as we went. This is where we work. It's a pretty spectacular spot. The actual building where we do most of our field work is right here, and there are no roads. It's about a 3-hour hike from the nearest road, but it has everything we need in order to have it as a base camp for what we do. But we've got to get our stuff up there. So we use donkeys. This is a donkey with a bunch of our plants in it that'll take them up the mountain. Or sometimes things get brought in on helicopters. This summer we're bringing up about 3,000 plants by helicopter. But we often walk up on our feet, okay? And as we go up, we take data about the distribution of the hosts and the distributions of the disease. We have a good time. We've brought lots of students over. I noticed when I was putting this together this morning that we've been doing this a long time. That's my daughter about when we started, year two or so, and that's my daughter now. And we definitely put our kids and our spouses to work at this. And this is inside that refuge at the top of the mountain where they have showers and beds and espresso and Wi-Fi and stuff like that. It's very civilized. And here we are sitting at the table sorting out healthy from diseased flowers. Okay. All right, so what did we do? We hike up the mountain, and every 100 meters in elevation, we'd record the first population of a given species we found and whether it was diseased or not. Okay, we would sit down and also take some local density data and record various types of information about the disease we found. Okay. This is a map showing the collection of hikes that we did in the local area. We looked at over 700 populations in these elevational transects over the course of several years. And we went from about maybe 400, maybe as low as 100 meters, up to about 2,500 meters. So what did we see? Well, first, what we saw, okay, this is just the hosts. We see that the hosts, for example, as you go up in elevation on this axis, some hosts are abundant, and then they decline in density as you get towards some margin of where they can survive. And this is shown for 6 different species. We have this gradient in abundance as they approach some margin. And sometimes they're approaching their margin from below, okay? And in a couple of cases, we're approaching a margin from above. What about the disease? Is there a disease-free halo? So in black here, or in gray, it's actually showing the abundance of the disease incidence, or prevalence within these populations. And if there was a disease-free halo, we would expect the disease to drop out before the host has reached its margin. And we don't see that in any of these cases. And in fact, in a couple cases, we see an increase in disease close to the margin, or we see some that are relatively flat. I also want to note that this disease that we're studying is not trivial to these organisms. This is the Black Death of these plant populations. This host here, which we sort of focus on quite a bit now, has about a 50 to 60% prevalence of this disease. And when infected, those plants don't reproduce ever again. They get diseased and they stay diseased for many years, just producing the pathogen. In Europe, the second great plague killed about a third of the humans in Northern Europe. This is essentially killing about 50% of all adult individuals in these populations. And yet they're persisting with this forever, right? As far as we can tell, right? They're persisting under these plague-like conditions. Okay, so what did we conclude from this study was that there doesn't appear to be a disease-free halo. That's consistent with this vector-transmitted disease in those lower density marginal populations. And this was the first study to ever document that type of absence of a disease-free halo. The prior studies that I'd mentioned showed a disease-free halo, but this one here is different because the transmission is based upon this searching behavior of those insect vectors. Okay, so what are we doing currently? I'll spend just about 5 minutes or so talking about what we're doing right now. That was our last project, and our current project is extending it to try to understand the interplay between the vector-borne and the proximity-based types of transmission. And we pursue this in a couple of ways that I'll talk about. One is that we're going out and we're mapping these natural populations and trying to understand how disease prevalence relates to differences in density among those populations. And you can see this is an example. We very typically will set out these grids of lines at meter scale and map the diseased and healthy hosts at very fine resolution. The other thing that we've been doing just in the last year or so are manipulative experiments in order to adjust host density and see what effect there is on the transmission of disease. And this is, again, where these plant models are incredibly useful. So we have found that we can take these little floral vials that you'd get from the florist to keep your carnations alive. Well, we can put our flowers in those and set them out in gridded arrays. So here's one, there's one, there's one, there's one, there's one, going on back. And then the insects will come in and visit those flowers and move the pathogen around to the nearby plants. We're testing this hypothesis that at lower densities, really it's the vector dispersal by the insects that's important. And at higher densities, it's really this passive proximity-based transmission of the disease that's important. And this is just showing some results from a theoretical model that gives us some predictions. Here you can see a healthy and diseased flower of the species that we're working on. We go from very high densities. This is about a 20-centimeter spacing of plants where this population will have about 700 or so individuals in it. Try doing that with humans. In the Alps. And we've been able to show that even when we vary the density, sorry, this is that most dense population at a 20 centimeter spacing, 200 centimeter spacing. Here we are at a meter spacing and at a 2 meter spacing. We get very similar dynamics of the spread of disease from this central area where we put the source of disease out into the neighboring regions where we had the healthy individuals. So some of these dynamics seem to be relatively independent of the density of hosts. We spent a lot of time in the last year and in this coming summer observing the pollinators visiting the diseased flowers and actually moving the pathogen from them to healthy plants. We spent hours and hours. Pollinator observations is a pretty drab kind of thing to do. You're in a beautiful place, but you're staring down at the ground for good hour stretches. We've encountered a few hazards along the way. This is one of our hazards, which is cows. There is a plant there in that circle that she very deliberately chews and moves on. And we've also begun to experiment with some new methodologies using bridal veil to exclude the vectors of the disease, be like using mosquito nets in order to exclude the malaria transmission by mosquitoes, and seeing how much does that affect the rates of disease transmission. Okay, so those are a few flavors of the types of research that we've been doing. I have to both acknowledge and thank a long slew of students. And these are just the Amherst students over the last decade that have been involved in these projects. And remember, this is a project collaborative with University of Virginia, University of Paris, and now in the last few years also Cal Berkeley has been involved. And we've been bringing students from each of those institutions together for the field work over the summers. And then the funding agency is also a good combination of support from the NSF, which is intended to fund basic research, but also we're very happy and impressed that the National Institutes of Health has also seen the connections between what we're able to do with these model systems of plants and connect those back to these broader fundamental issues relevant to disease across very diverse types of systems, including in humans. Okay, so that's my spiel. And if you guys have any questions, I'd be delighted to answer them. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, don't have organ systems remotely like you know, mammalian or vertebrate species. You know, everything gets sick, everything dies, but that doesn't get you very far in understanding the sort of the inner workings of.
Right.
Just talk a little bit about your confidence that
sure.
you can analogize between these two kingdoms.
Yeah. It's very true that there are striking differences, particularly in the way that we defend ourselves against infections as mammal systems versus how plants do it. And that's our adaptive immune response, production of antibodies. Both systems, both plants and animals, have a basic or innate immune system that responds upon the first exposure to pathogens. And recent studies of the last 5 years or so have found really remarkable similarity in the detection and elicitation of that innate immune system function. But the plants lack the adaptive immune response. In both plant and animal systems, these effects of density for diseases that are spread by proximity contact or diseases that are spread by vectors is where the analogy is most strong. We see, for example, that if we look in animal species, that diseases that are spread by vectors or spread by sexual transmission, persist in populations as they decline towards extinction, while the density-dependent diseases, those that require proximity and non-sexual contact, tend to drop out of the populations before the host reaches extinction. That is a commonality observed in both animal systems and in plant systems. And it's underlied by the same fundamental of transmission dynamics. So when we prepare our studies, we are constantly looking across the plant and animal literature for studies to give context to what we're doing. And so for that last example about the sexual transmission or vector-borne diseases being lost from rare and endangered species, there was a really excellent study by Sonia Altheiser at the University of Georgia in animals where we did a study subsequent to that in plants that found the exact same dynamics going on. So another thing that's important to recognize is that in both plant and animal systems, the disease imposes a fitness cost, by definition, reduces survival or reproduction of the host. That then creates a selection for mechanisms to avoid or resist those diseases. And those are the same in plant and animal systems. And so we can see the evolution of some resistance mechanisms that have parallels between the two kingdoms. Yeah.
I wonder why, I mean, you can explain it in a very non-Ewaldian way, the chestnut thereby destroying the host of whatever exotic factor it was that caused the disease mm-hmm. and killed them all. Mm-hmm. But left open this gigantic adaptive niche,
yeah.
which resistant trees.
Ah.
The same way.
Yeah, it's yeah.
The same way that honeybees.
It's interesting.
Grow
yeah.
Mite,
yeah.
Which wiped out honeybees throughout North America.
Yeah.
Within a few decades, resistant strains emerged.
Yeah, it's interesting. The chestnut's a really curious and potentially a sad example where the disease came in from Chinese chestnuts into New York, and American chestnuts were at remarkably high densities, resulting in the spread of that disease down the Appalachians. The trees are still alive, actually. Their root systems persist 100 years later, and they send up little chestnut suckers that just don't get big enough to reproduce because the disease is still here and it wipes them out. However, what happened in the history of the chestnut blight is once they saw the chestnuts were dying, they went out and started to timber the living chestnuts because when they died and fell on their own, they were less valuable lumber than when you fell them yourself. So what they did was, if there was genetic variation for resistance to chestnut blight, they killed them. And that may have, I mean, we don't know, but it's potentially a sad story that we may have prevented the reestablishment of the American chestnut.
Most likely to get
yeah, that's right. And those were the ones they were heading out to cut down for timber. Yeah, yeah. Yes? Right. Certainly that's very possible that other factors affecting transmission might vary over those densities. One of the reasons that we feel more confident about this disease-free halo idea is that we see it whether we're looking down at a margin that's coming down the mountain or a margin that's coming up the mountain. We see it across a range of environmental gradients that would suggest if it was just there are fewer pollinators up high, right, then maybe that could create more disease pressure on a lower margin. Because as you approach that margin, you're also reaching an area with higher pollinator abundance, right? But we see the same pattern whether we're looking up the mountain or down the mountain. And so that seems to us to suggest that it's probably not driven so strongly by pollinator abundance gradients that would correlate with elevation. And these plants, one of the details is they're not pollinated by very specific vectors. These are pretty generalist skipper butterflies, hoverflies, things like that, which will visit everything in the community. Yes, and we're seeing it experimentally. We're selecting for resistance as well, and so it's keeping pace with what's happening in the field.
And I wonder if you're more likely to see host resistance to a pathogen where the density is highest.
Right.
In the same way that we've in, you know, let's say in tuberculosis or even
yeah.
The AIDS.
Yeah. It's a great question, and something that is part of our current project is to get at these dynamics of resistance and how those might be influenced by the density of the population. There's another really interesting dynamic to that, in that at low densities, we expect the transmission of the disease to be primarily by the insect pollinators. And at high densities, we expect the transmission to be a combination of the insect movement and also this proximity effect. When you look at the low-density pollinator-driven disease, that's only among adult individuals. So there's an age-dependent disease transmission. You only get pollinators visiting you when you're an adult. While when you are at high densities, you can get the proximity transmission when you're juveniles or seedlings. And so our approach is to look at whether these plants might be allocating resources to defenses at, depending on the density of their population, to either the seedling resistance or adult resistance. And there are many instances, or several instances, I shouldn't say many, where age-dependent resistance has been observed. Seedling, whether we're talking about plants as seedling versus adults, whether we're talking about various animals at different life history stages. So we are very interested in that question. We do see a lot of variation in resistance, and we do see that it has a strong genetic component. So selection ought to be incredibly strong if it's essentially removing from the gene pool 50% of the individuals which are susceptible genotypes. Right. Yeah.
Is the disease-free halo essentially analogous to herd immunity, where there's not enough susceptible individuals to keep a chain of transmission, either by proximity infection or by vector transmission?
No, it's not. It's not like herd immunity. You could imagine that more complex ecological communities could have what are called dilution effects on the transmission of the disease. Or even in a single species, if you get very, very, very high densities, the spread of the disease by the vectors will go down because not every individual will get visited by a vector, right? But at those very high densities, it's the passive proximity transmission of the disease that takes over. So there doesn't seem to be a herd immunity dynamic that takes place in this particular system. Yeah?
I was struck by something you said at the very beginning of your talk. I was wondering if you just maybe restate it and clarify. You said
sure.
Something to the effect that there are more pathogens.
Yeah, sure. Not more than human. Yeah. Yeah, so the majority of species on the planet are parasites or pathogens. And the way you can come to that conclusion turns out to be really a simple observation, that every free-living host has at least one species-specific parasite or pathogen. And in fact, in most cases, they've got a dozen or two dozen. Humans are thought to have several dozen, human-specific, that only occur on humans. Guinea worm, for example, right? Only occurs on human populations for that stage of its life cycle. So if every free-living host has at least one, and if not many, parasites or pathogens that are specialized only to it, then that pool becomes much greater. It's a product, right, of how many free living species there are times the average number of free living species specific parasites or pathogens there are. There are probably 10 times as many parasites and pathogens as free living species. But who knows, right?
Scary world.
We tend not to study them. They're small, right? And so we tend not to have a good accounting of them. Right? But that logical argument can get you there. So I've argued, I mean, I do disease biology in the biology department. I've argued if you're going to understand biology, you really ought to understand disease biology, because the majority of species on the planet, that's what they do. It's at least the plurality, right, if not the majority of life history strategies on the planet. Okay. Oh, yeah, sure.
Really, what I want to tell you, we were seniors here. One of our classmates designed a study every Friday night. He'd go to the local grocery and get two lobsters. He'd bring them back, he'd dissect the spinal cord, he'd do his experiments on electrical transmission, then he would discard the two lobsters. We went to the dorm and had the discard for dinner.
So I could do this work in the Piedmont of North Carolina, but no thanks. I lived there for a long time, and I take some lessons from my collaborators. Tatiana Giraud has studied the noble rot that is used in dessert wines. She has studied truffle fungi, and then one evening I got an email from her that said I'm studying the blue cheese fungus, and I'm trying to get samples from around the world, and I found a site that will deliver, but they won't deliver to me in France, but they'll deliver in the U.S. Can I have them send some to you? And at 11 o'clock, I replied, sure, happy to do it. We'll sample the fungus and send it back to you. The next morning, I woke up with $1,500 worth of receipts in my inbox for blue cheese. And we had to buy a new refrigerator when all this blue cheese came in. So there is something about picking your model system, but you have to be careful, I guess, is the message. No, the Italian Alps are an amazing, amazing place. And in fact, we didn't choose this site by chance. If you look at the species richness map, right, it's a heat map of how many species there are in a given place. Within the Carnation family, this particular location is a hot spot. The other is in Croatia, which is just not as easy to do our work in as where we do our work. So, but thanks for your compliment. Yes.
Definitely made me think of one of our professors 50 years ago, Lincoln Brower.
Yeah.
Found it necessary to spend a good portion of the year in the Caribbean studying monarch butterflies.
Right. Professor Tomelez is currently in the Caribbean studying hummingbirds. Yes. But I don't advertise that you get to go to Italy. Isn't that true? Maybe the word is out on the street, but... I don't advertise that you get to go to Italy. I advertise that you're going to have to do a lot of hard work. And then we get great people coming over with us. We do have a fantastic time. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.